This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
I'm Andrew Johnstone, and you're listening to The Last Breath, the podcast about death and dying, brought to you by Hospice Waikato and Free FM, the Waikato's community access media organisation. In this episode, Lauren Fenn, the clinical nurse manager of Rainbow Place at Hospice Waikato, talks about children's palliative care.
Advanced life-limiting or incurable disorder or disease. So there is no hope of a cure, and there will be a journey to end of life, but when that may be, could be months, could be many, many years. So it's, and there's about 301 different conditions that sit under the term palliative care, pediatric palliative care. So it's just working and walking alongside that journey with them. I am Lauren Fenn, and I am the clinical nurse manager of Rainbow Place.
And how did you fall into the sphere of children's palliative care? And that's a difficult word to say.
It is. So I've been here about 4 years. I came from the hospital, and I worked in the paediatric wards my entire nursing career. On the surgical ward, which it wasn't just the surgical ward, it had ENT, plastics, dental, oncology, general surgical, orthopaedics, so it had many different specialties. I really enjoyed the oncology side of it, so kind of the palliative care side of it.
So oncology is
cancer.
Yeah.
Yep. So these families were on a long journey, where they could get cure, but they also may turn palliative. So I enjoyed the connection that you got with these families. They weren't just in and out like all of the other surgical families were. You got to know them, really walk alongside them and help them in that journey. So that's kind of why I came this way. And then I also have a child that has a disability myself. So I guess I have a lot of personal experiences and understanding of what these families go through.
Okay, well, you've just answered my first question. It's like getting emotionally involved with a family over a long period of time with a child whose outcomes aren't great. Not everybody could do that.
No, definitely not everybody can do that.
Because there's a big emotional price tag that comes with that, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And you definitely... because our children are on our books for such a long time, like they can come on at zero and we don't discharge them till 21. Like you know them for years. Like I've known some of our patients, I looked after them on the ward and now I'm looking after them here. So I've known them their entire life and they're about six, seven. So you become part of their family, but you just have to have that boundary.
Now, sorry?
It can be challenging. That's
Yeah. You don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but I would like to ask about your own child's disabilities.
Yep.
And I grew up with a sister with disabilities, so I do have a little bit of empathy and insight.
Yep.
So I'm not asking that flippantly.
Yep. So my son is just turned 17. He's not biologically my son. We adopted him when he was 5 weeks old. He has suffered a brain injury. When we first got him, we were told that he potentially may never walk or talk. The outcomes could be, we didn't really know. We have sat by his bedside in ICU while he's been on a ventilator and sat there and thought, I don't know if you're going to come through this, or if you are, what is your life going to be like? I call him my cat with nine lives, and he's definitely used a few of those, but we definitely have a lot of challenges, and a lot of it's around the social side. His injuries mainly in his frontal lobe, so understanding people's cues, their behaviours, what they mean by something, how he speaks to them and is perceived can be a challenge on a regular basis. But he, if you walk past him in the street, you'd think he looks like a normal child. But yeah, he's got a lot of, definitely a lot of issues. We're about to have major surgery on his back. He's got scoliosis, so he'll have rods put in his back.
What's scoliosis?
His spine's curved. So if we leave it, it'll start to crush his internal organs. So he'll have some big metal rods put up his spine. But then on the other hand of that, he's just passed level 2 NCA, and I'm incredibly proud of him for doing that. He works so, so hard to achieve, and he has such big aspirations for himself that he should just be able to do everything that everyone else can do.
And what are his aspirations? What does he want to do?
He really wants to give back to the disability community. He wants to be able to advocate for other people that have a disability. He loves playing sports, so he plays wheelchair basketball. So he enjoys that side of it, yeah. But he also has just done a coffee making course and would like to be a barrister as well. So who knows what he will do and where it will go. I think the biggest concern will be just learning to, he has a teacher aide with him all the time, just because he will either say something the wrong way or misinterpret something, and it can just blow up quite quickly. So it'll be him integrating into adult life without somebody right beside him guiding him through that, like his teacher aide has done through his schooling journey. So I'm not sure how that will go. I don't know if he'll ever leave home. He's a very kind person who probably would give you all the money if you conned him enough into it. So yeah, just working out a safe space for him. But he's incredibly intelligent for, yeah, his struggles that he goes through.
So you have a lot of responsibilities in your personal life.
Yes.
And you have an extraordinary amount of responsibility in your professional life.
Yeah, yeah.
That must be really hard to juggle. I would imagine it would be hard to juggle.
Yes, it definitely is. But, I don't know, just make it work. I have a very supportive husband, so, and two other children, and yeah, we just make it work.
And how old are your other children?
My other children is 14 and 11, and they are all heavily into sports as well. So I guess that's my outlet, going to their sports, living through them.
Very busy life.
Yes, definitely, yep.
How did you make that, you've made that decision, you're going to go into palliative care, looking after children
yep.
who need palliative care full time. Big step.
Mm-hmm.
Did you? I guess you had to think about that a lot, or did once you made that decision, you just leapt into it?
Once I had made the decision to, I guess I was really comfortable in. I'd been on the same ward for 16 years, so I was very comfortable where I worked. So it was quite a big step to move out of that. But I'd been on a study day to Rainbow Place, and I thought, man, I really like that place. That aligns with all my values. You can actually sit, you have time to be with your patients, you know, you can really advocate for them. So yeah, once I had made that decision, it was quite easy to move over. And I originally came here as a registered nurse, and I worked in the inpatient unit. We were just doing respite until COVID hit, and then we kind of changed and did a bit of community work as well. And then the job came up for the nurse manager of the role, so I went for that.
Can you describe to me what respite is, please?
Respite, so we, our service, the children come into our service, they come into the inpatient unit. We've got two bedrooms over there, and they come in, we admit them, and they have one-on-one care with a nurse and an HCA, so the family can just actually go and have a break. Often they just go and sleep. Catch up with the other children, garden, do things that probably a lot of people take for granted that these parents don't actually have time to because their child is so medically heavy in the care that is needed for them.
So let's talk about Rainbow Place for a second, mm-hmm. just describe it. So at the moment we're sitting in Rainbow Playground, is that correct?
This is the old Rainbow Place, well, this is the Rainbow Place Lounge. So we have actually just recently moved down to Creative Space because it's a much larger space with a lots of sun, lino, so that if we do messy play, we can just go for it. So Rainbow Place is the pediatric side, but we go up to 21. So we do 0 to 21 for children. You just have to have a life-limiting condition to be on our service. It doesn't mean that you're going to be imminently passing away. We do a lot of things with the families. It's not just either respite care or home visits. We're really there to walk alongside their journey with them. So we go in and meet the families regularly, sit down and catch up with them to see how things are going for them. Just listening to, a lot of the time they need to just have somebody to listen. They want a debrief of what's been going on. Often we will say they're having a hard time at the hospital with a certain, they've been admitted or they need to have this done through clinic, but it's not happening, the wait lists are massive, or they've had a doctor that doesn't want to listen to what they, how it's going for them, because they want to be put into this box where that doesn't work for their family. So it's a lot of listening to what they're going through. Through that, you tease out what they need from you. You will then be like, would you like me to go back to that person and, you know, advocate for you? So you'll do a lot of that. Sometimes we'll go into schools, we'll help them educate in there, and just sit there and, yeah, if they need, like some of our children go to the special schools and some of them go to mainstream. So if they're going into mainstream, the teachers need a lot of education on these children, and how to manage their medical needs, their social, their communication needs. So we'll go in and support them there. And then we have our respite service, which supports the families to just have a little bit of a break. And we offer three different types of respites. Yep. So we do our overnight stuff. So it's Wednesday to Friday, where they get two nights where they can come in. They just bring everything that they would need to care for their child in, and we do everything. So that it's one-on-one care. There's always a nurse and an HCA, and we take two children at a time. Then we have a day respite service, which has actually come from an idea of a parent. Most of our children are too complex to go to a normal kindy, so they don't get a break during the day. So we have created it's kind of like a daycare type service. So it runs 9 till 3 on a Tuesday, and they'll come in. There's usually about 4 kids that come in, so they get to, you know, socialise with their peers, which is really lovely to see some of these children that don't want to have a bar of anybody else grow confidence and socialise with another person, and make their own choices.
So when you say that they don't want a bar of anybody else, where does that come from?
They have, it can be their syndrome, so a lot of them can have like autistic traits or ADHD or just sensory issues, sensory overload, or they've been and spent a lot of their time in hospital and they actually don't want people around them, because generally if people are around them, they're going to do something that hurts them. So it's just, yeah. And they are so medically fragile that they are often kept in a bubble of their household. Yeah. That going out and interacting with other people is not something that they are often used to. So being in the, I guess you'd call it the protection of our service, where no parent wants to be around bugs, they get to interact with other kids. They can, you know, either play alongside or play with. They can make choices. They do arts together. I was going through some of our photos the other day, and there's two pictures of these bigger boys, and they can talk to you. It's limited in what they will say to you, but they're sitting there and they're holding each other's hand, and the smiles on their faces just, yeah, melt your heart.
Do any of the kids develop long-term friendships with each other?
Yep. We do have a few that request to come in together. They want to do respite together, or we kind of think you might be a good match and we'll pair them up. So, yeah, they do enjoy their time with some, yeah.
So you've got overnight stay, mm-hmm. You have daycare.
Yep.
And
then we do have another one where we go into their home. And so we'll do in-home or hospital respite. So that's generally for children that are new to the book, so they can gain confidence in the team. Like, it takes a lot for these parents to say, you can have my child and I trust that you can look after them. I guess a lot of that is not, they've spent a lot of time in the hospital and either meds are late, they don't have enough time, or this is the way that we do it, so this is how we'll do it for everybody, where maybe that doesn't work for them. So it's just going in and building that confidence that we can look after your child. We will do exactly how you want it unless there's a safety concern. We also use it for parents that are just completely burnt out and can't function. So if they just need a little bit of time, we'll go in and do in home. And then there's some of our families that are in hospital for up to a year. So we'll go up onto the ward and we'll sit with the child so that they could just go out, go do some supermarket shopping, go to a GP, go home for a little bit. Yeah.
So when a parent is, I mean, you can imagine being burnt out.
Mm-hmm.
How does that manifest?
A lot of the time for them, you see it, they're either just really emotional and tearful, they're angry, or they just can't cope with anything, and they just can't get out of bed, they can't function. They often question everything that they're doing. Am I doing it the right way? Am I advocating for my child the correct way? Should I be doing something different? They question all their decisions that they're making.
Child aside, it must place an awful strain on a marriage.
Yep, and all the other siblings. Like, it's a huge, I guess, the carer burden is massive for these families. It's not like it's a full-time job looking after their child. Then they have to do all of the other children. Sometimes they even have to hold down a job because they financially can't. You know, it's expensive these days. And then on top of that, you have a child that needs probably a lot more things than a normal kid would need, and you, not all of that's free. They still have to pay for all of that. So, yep, there's a lot of supporting families as a whole. We do run a sibling day at Rainbow Place every school holidays, which is just a day for the siblings. And they all come in together. We do it from 5 to 12-year-olds. And it's a special day for them. So we order them pizza, we do movies, we do arts and crafts, just whatever they want to do, we will do that. We've been lucky enough to partner with Silverdale Normal School and they've let us use one of their classrooms. So there's like a playground, a movie, there's a kitchen area which we do decorate some baking. And it's just really a day that's about them and it's special for them. And there's lots of really great friendships that have been made through there too, which is nice to see.
And I guess it gives mum and dad time to just to catch a breath, maybe have a sleep.
Yep.
We'll go out for a coffee with each other.
Yeah, definitely. We'll often run on-site respite that same day so that some of these families that have, you know, either all of the kids will be cared for, so which is quite nice for them to actually get a break.
Now, before I turned the recorder on, you were saying that you have 75 children under care?
Between 65 and 70.
And how many people in your team?
There is 3 registered nurses, 3 healthcare assistants, and myself and another clinical nurse specialist. So there's only 8 of us.
That's a lot of children to care for.
Yeah.
And I guess they're spread out all over the greater Waikato area?
Yes, yep. So we cover the entire, so down to Tambaranui up to the Coromandel.
And everywhere in between?
Yep.
So a lot of travelling?
Yeah, yep, there can be a lot of travelling. Yep, we've got a few that are about, our furthest is about 2.5 hours away at the moment.
So when a nurse visits a home, how often do they make that visit? Is it once a week or as required?
It depends on what the needs are for the family. So if you had a patient that was very unwell, end of life, it would be daily to multiple times a week. Most of our families we will visit, so if they're quite high needs, probably monthly we would catch up with them. Otherwise, it may be spread out to once every 2 months.
Or whenever, when they might ring and say we need some help.
Yep,
what
they
need.
Yep, sometimes they are in a really good space and they're actually like, I don't need you right now. I will contact you when I do need you, but I'm just living life and it's good, so I don't need to catch up with you. And that's totally fine.
So what happens when a nurse visits a child in their home? What kind of things do you do? What do you offer?
So if we're just going in for a home visit, it's generally we sit there, sit down, walk in, work out what the pressing issues are at that stage. The parent will generally just start unloading to you.
So you're a therapist as well?
Yep. Yep. So we listen to whatever they may be. So say schooling's not going at the moment. I'm really struggling with this, this and this at school. And just listen to them. Like, we are a safe, non-judgmental space where they can download whatever they need to do. And then you kind of tease out what you're going to help them with. I can help you with this because I know this person, this person. I'm happy to send an email. I can come in into a meeting with you. So you work out where you can be useful for them. Sometimes they might be like, actually, I've got it all sorted. I just needed you to listen to that. And, you know, thank you for listening. Often you'll talk about completely random things. They'll divert off course because sometimes just talking about that all the time is too hard. So you'll talk about chickens. You'll talk about the animals. You know, you talk about the rest of the family.
Sometimes you're really just a voice. You're just somebody, just company.
Yeah, yeah.
Just somebody who's different from outside.
Yeah, yeah. And I think because you're not associated with the hospital, you have time to just sit there and listen to what they need you to listen to, and that's often the most important for them. We've been told, like, hospice is like a family. You're like our second family. We can just sit there and talk. And we have recently created, so we have some morning teas that our family supports. We've got one on site that all the family's invited to. So kids, siblings, grandparents come in, which is really good for them all to interact with other families and great space. But then we've also created one off site, which is just like a parent only morning tea, and it's a place where they can, you're there to facilitate and listen to what they need to, but they create friendships within the group and some of the conversations that they have. Yeah, like they'll either download about what's been really awful for them, or sometimes they'll be like talking about nappies and butts and, you know, just things that you wouldn't be able to talk about in any other normal parent group.
So you've got peers who understand.
Yep, people that understand exactly what you're going through, and they're not going to judge you because my child's doing something different to your child, or my child can't do that and your child can. It's a space of no judgment.
And a place to socialise with safe people who understand.
Yep.
Because people often don't understand, do they?
They don't. They don't understand. And a lot of our families actually lose their friends once they've had this child, because their friends don't know what to do, how to react, and they just feel like they can't tell them everything because they're complaining constantly. That's what they kind of feel like. That's how they've expressed it. So to be able to talk to somebody that understands what they're going through, even though it's a different journey, is quite useful and therapeutic for them.
And I'm guessing that friendships are formed?
Yeah, yep, definitely. Yep, there's friendships formed, which is nice.
So they can meet up at each other's homes, perhaps, and keep it on going.
Yeah, yep. Some of our families definitely meet up and catch up.
Mm. Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Now, two questions I want to ask you from what you've been saying. Doctors who don't listen, that really surprises me.
I don't feel like it's on purpose, but I think that our children are so medically complex that, and these parents have tried every single tiny little thing that somebody's thrown at them to be like, this could help, this could help, and they've tried it all. But sometimes in the hospital, you kind of just, they want to stick you in a box because this is what how it should be done, this is what should be done, and sometimes it just doesn't work. And it's not that they don't want to listen. Sometimes they kind of just get stuck in that, well, this is how it should be. This is what should be done, or this is the treatment that should work, but it might not work. So it's just, yeah. It's just advocating and being that voice where I think parents either don't feel comfortable to say some things, or they don't feel like the doctor's going to listen to them enough. So when it comes from a health professional, it just gives it a little bit more weight.
And do doctors listen?
Yeah.
I mean, on their behalf, their defence, I guess, I mean, they've probably been incredibly busy as well.
Oh, very busy.
And sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, they are very busy. And sometimes it's also our job to, because you've worked with these doctors before, you understand where the point that they're coming from. Mm. Or how they're trying to explain something to a family that maybe they're not quite understanding. So you can be that bridge, the gap. You can sit there and say, this is why they're telling you this, because of this. It might not work like that for you, but that's okay. This is their reasoning behind it. Like, you can give a little bit more context so that the families just understand it a little bit more and don't go defensive straight away. They understand the process a little bit better.
And I guess sometimes there's the potential for clash of personalities.
Yeah.
And if you're a parent who's already under a great deal of stress and you're already run down emotionally or physically, it's very easy to get upset and angry and defensive.
Yep.
So it is quite complex.
It is very complex. And it's often, there's just so many things said to them in those appointments that not everything goes in. So if you're there with them, you can be like, oh, and they said this, this, and this. And the family's like, oh, I didn't actually hear that. And you give them guidance on how they can implement that in their home, like what that will look like. So, yeah, and there can be classes of personalities, which we just facilitate and kindly guide them to requesting for a different paediatrician which does work.
Teachers, school teachers, having a child with medical high needs, in your class, that's a big ask, because teachers are already very busy.
Yeah.
And it's not just being in the classroom and managing all the kids in the class, it's all the extracurricular work they have to do. So that, and I'm not saying this in an unkind way, but it must add a burden to the teacher's day.
Yeah, yep.
And I guess not all teachers can cope with that.
No. Definitely not. Not all schools can cope with that, and you kind of work out the schools that are willing to work with the families to make things work.
So when you say some schools can't cope with that, what does that mean? That they're not willing to cope, or they're not equipped to cope?
Probably that they're not equipped to cope, because when a child gets funding to go to a school, and not all children get AWS funding, which is the funding that gives you a teacher aid. So not all children get that. There's quite a strict criteria that you have to go through to get that funding. So if a child doesn't get that, or your child gets AWS funding but it's not a lot, so school is roughly 30 hours a week if a child went full-time. I don't think there's any children that have full 30 hours of AWS funding. I think you would get that if you were ACC funded, but not through AWS. So if a child then wants to go to school for that amount of time and they're going into mainstream, the school actually has to top that up, the funding, so that they can provide a teacher aid with them. But most schools can't do that.
Oh, it's not that simple, is it?
Yeah, they can't meet the needs of that because it's just not financially, which is hard.
Could you just tell me what AWS means, please?
Ooh.
It's an acronym.
It is an acronym. I'd actually have to look that up.
Got nothing to do with rowing.
No.
It's just part of the Department of Education or Health System, just a funding organisation.
It's just a funding stream that you can, and it pays for a teacher aid to have hours. And then there's like high health needs. So there's different kind of streams of funding. The funding for these children is incredibly complex. And I'm sure that you've seen through the media recently that a lot of funding has been cut for families, or the criteria that they can spend their funding on has changed. So it causes a lot of stress and anxiety for our families around their funding.
Well, that's irritating.
It is. And almost every year, they have to go through what they call a needs assessment to assess that child still has the same amount of disability and still needs the same amount of money provided for them. So they're constantly having to prove, I need this money, I need this support to just live life.
So that just adds an extra burden to the family, just one more thing they have to do.
Yep.
Which sounds very unfair.
It is. Yep.
Yeah. So kudos to the schools and teachers that are able to assist. And I guess the school's got to have things like wheelchair ramps and bathrooms that can be used by somebody with...
accessibility. And then safety, because not all of our children are in chairs. Some of them are mobile and they can move very quickly and they would go. So some of them are runners, so they've got to have fencing and just somebody with them. So there's a lot of education that goes and preparation that goes into having a child at a mainstream school. If they went to a special school, I guess you'd class it as easier because they put all the funding in together and then they have lots and lots of teacher aides and specialty teachers. They have occupational therapists and physios that are in those schools to support those kids. But the wait list for Hamilton special schools at the moment is huge. It's probably a good year. So even if you wanted to go to those schools, you can't get into them straight away.
I'm going to ask you a hard question now. Mm-hmm. A child you've been looking after for years.
Yep.
Is dying now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they have 3 months left or a couple of weeks. How do you cope with that personally?
I mean, we've just had a few children in our service actually die, so I have been involved with them quite closely. I think that I don't really know how I cope with it personally, but I do.
Perhaps you've learned to cope with it?
Yeah, I think working in this job, you understand that, unfortunately, death is an inevitable process and it will happen. It's the journey that they go on to get there. And if you know that you've done everything to support that family, to be there for them, however that may be, and that child in the end has had a good death, they're peaceful, they're pain-free, that's what, I guess, gives you closure. You know you've done your job well, and at the end of the day, like, those final few moments for that child dying is some of the last memories that those parents have. And if that's peaceful, you know, it's, you've done your job properly, I guess you'd say.
How do children cope with death, the idea that they're going to die? I guess every child is different, of course.
Every child is different, and I don't think that a lot of our children have that understanding that they are going to die. We have had a few that did know that they were going to die, and it wouldn't always be a topic that they would want to talk about or bring up, but then just slowly talking about things. We often will do a goals of care with our families. So it's what's really important to that family. A lot of our families, so one of our families, it's really important for my child to eat for as long as they can because they really enjoy eating food. We have had one girl that she didn't really want to talk about it, and there was probably only one conversation that was had about what would happen when you die and what do you want? And she was old enough and cognitively able to articulate what she wanted. So she laid out, I really want this, this and this done. This is my favourite colour. I want to be dressed in that. And she, took peace from it, but it was not talked about again. It came up once and that was the opportunity to talk about it.
Mm. and your own feelings. You've developed feelings for the children in your care.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sad. It's really sad. And I do cry. Like, I go to the, I do go to their funerals. A lot of people are like, I don't want to go to a funeral. But I actually feel like going to their funeral or their tangi gives me closure, and it's respect for that child's life, that family, the journey they've been on. And yeah, I cry there, but then, and you feel a bit sad, and it's a lot of work when they are in that end of life phase. So it's kind of, I guess it's a little bit of a relief as well.
And this is something I've come across time and again. It's a relief, and it's often a relief for the people who've been left behind.
Yeah.
And then there comes that struggle of feeling that relief, the guilt that comes with that.
Yeah.
I feel relieved, but I shouldn't feel that way.
Yeah. And what do I do with this huge space that's left because of all the medical care that I had to provide for this child for sometimes years and months? Now what do I do? Like, there's a massive void that's left. So we go out, we keep in contact with our families for a good year to 18 months after they pass away, and we will go and do the visits. We can use the family services, the counsellors and the bereavement counsellors if the family want to, but often they don't want to meet a new person. So they've developed that relationship with you for many, many years. They don't want to talk to a new person. They just want to be able to sit there and talk to you about things. And often it's just asking how are you going? And letting them express those feelings.
And I would imagine that time of readjustment, this new phase of life, it could take a good year to get your head around and to start feeling like you can move on.
Mm. Yep, a long time, definitely. And it's we often work with other agencies to support the families in having, so they get angel casts made of their hands, so that they still have something that they can hold on to, or if they want their ashes turned into jewellery, we'll have the ashes. We have working relationships with all those charities out there that can facilitate those for the families. And we have two amazing photographers in our team that will also go out and do photos for the family. So it's just creating those mementos, those keepsakes that they can have.
And of course, it's not just mum and dad, it's the other siblings as well.
Yeah.
They're big adjustments for everyone.
Mm. Yep.
And grieving.
Yeah.
All kinds of levels of grief.
Yeah. Yep. Definitely.
To finish up, do you have any personal reflections about the job that you do and the service that you personally offer to the community, and things that you've learned, wisdom?
I think when I think about my job, I love my job. I have never loved a job so much as I love this one. And it's about, like, death and dying is part of paediatric palliative care, but it is not what defines our service. It's making sure that these families and these children can live their best life, can make some happy moments, have a great life, and it's making that happen for the families, and that's probably the most rewarding thing. This summer we took a group of children in wheelchairs, not all of them were, but some of them were, out on a fishing boat, and we managed to, free of charge, a Wish for Fish charity, have a massive big boat which is fully equipped for children to go up in lifts and go out, and all of these kids and their parents went fishing.
And they enjoyed it?
They loved it. Yep, they loved it.
Wow, it sounds complicated.
It's probably very complicated. And, like, the fact that this boat has, like, a lift and a hoist and, you know, But these kids got to go out in a boat and they got to go fishing. Like, they got to live their best life, something that most of the time you wouldn't think that they would ever be able to do. But that happened, and that was awesome for them.
This conversation has just reminded me. Now, I'm hesitating to say a name because I keep on getting it wrong. It's Lauren.
Lauren, yes.
I got it right. I was saying Lauren before and it got stuck in my head. Lauren, every time I come to hospice and I talk to people here, I'm talking to palliative care specialists and bereaved and people who are dying.
Yeah.
It reminds me constantly just how blessed we are to have this service in the Waikato.
Mm. Yep.
You know, it's a resource-hungry organisation.
Mm.
It requires a lot, but in my other job as an oral historian, I'm talking to people often in their 80s and 90s, and you hear stories from another time when there was no hospice care.
Mm.
Families are left to cope on their own often, especially with children, very little outside help. And when people go into hospital to die, the families were often excluded.
Yeah.
So we are very lucky to have this service.
Yeah, we are lucky to have this service, and that it's a service that doesn't just focus on the patient. It's the whole family, and it's bringing joy to that family. It's dancing down the corridor with their wheelchair. We're the noisy people of hospice. And that's what I love about my job. It's bringing happiness and joy and support to those families that need it.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.